dear organizers, dear friends and colleagues, dear Frau Rode Daxa, dear delegates and guests, thanks very much for the kind invitation to speak to you tonight at the very first instantiation of your annual conference. That is an honor indeed. When I prepared this talk, I was afraid that it would amount to what the German proverb calls bringing owls to Athens, Eulen nach Athen tragen. I checked the English version of that is bringing coals to Newcastle. That perhaps is also not the newest one. So a less fossil fuel-based version of this might be bringing sand to the beach, but that also has unpleasant climate critical connotation. Okay, I'll leave that. You know what I mean, like bringing something to somewhere that has it in plenty. But despite these fears, I gravitated to the theme that I want to talk to quite forcefully and inevitably, and that is, again, Alfred Lorenzer. Across the first 1.5 days of this conference, I was quite pleased to hear and see that this theme still has some currency. It showed... Also, the specific theme that I want to pick up in Alfred Lorenzer showed in Vera King's talk yesterday, in Hans-Joachim Busch this morning, but most powerfully, perhaps, in Elfriede Löchel and Markus Brunner's presentations from today, earlier today. So I will also go back to Alfred Lorenzer's meta-theory and present you my take on it. And of course, I also need to mention my marching orders, as all of the lecturers got them, like the now by now famous three questions: how and where and in which form does the unconscious show in your research? Where do you situate unconscious processes? And does your approach entail an implicit metapsychological conception? If so, which one? I think, too, that these are substantial and good questions. And for those of you who have read the abstract that I submitted for the conference page, you might realize that I addressed the third one and tried to dodge the other two. But in line with that, I'll start with answering the third one after a kind of meta theory that I myself have. But since I have an hour of your time, I will also be able to touch upon the other things. So what I'll do with you in the following is to take you on a tour of what might be called my meta-methodological approach or conception, so as to point out the ways in which I try in my research to tickle out the unconscious dynamics situated in culture and society. At the same time, I want to show you and inquire together with you into how my specific conception of cultural analysis has been also a child of its time, of my generation, of the historical junctures that people around my age or people having lived through the past, say, 20, 30 years, more or less consciously. So that kind of this historical juncture that we've been living through, and how far do my theoretical and methodological orientations, and how far are they in line with certain structures of feeling that have been in the air and that impacted me, resonated within me when I developed my approach? So I also I'm trying to do a little bit of a self-reflection on why I like to think along certain paths about Lorenzer's theory. So I want to ask what kind of unconscious formation lies at the roots of my own psychosocial and cultural analytic approach. Ultimately, I argue for a variation of the depth hermeneutic tradition and its method of scenic understanding that unfolds along the lines of what I have called arrested hermeneutics, a mode of interpreting that repeatedly and incessantly seeks to capture the unconscious in the symbolic, all the while knowing that this is a foolishly impossible endeavor. Hence what Lorenzer has called Wiederholungsdrang, and others have called that too. So it's kind of painfully pleasurably painful urge to repeat. That is what I see as a drive structure that is the motor and central relay station for a successful in-depth hermeneutics of culture and society, at least for what I'm doing with it. This drive, I argue, can be fed and kept in motion through a mode of the comic, through humor and wit and their application during the interpretation process. So in this sense, then, let's approach Lorenzo once more with a ticklish feeling. And yes, you mentioned it already, like this is, so there is Katharina Rothe, Dan Rosengart, and my edition that at the core has Alfred Lorenz's tiefenhermeneutische Kulturanalyse in an English translation, which I think is really, really solid. I'm really proud of that. But it also has a couple of accompanying chapters, and one of them is my chapter on arrested hermeneutics. So in the following, I want to first say something about what I see as contradictions in Lorenzo, and then connect my understanding of those contradictions to what a colleague of mine at the Department of Media and Communications in Oslo, Tim Vermeulen, has called the metamodernistic moment. So he's a theorist of metamodernism. I'm not too crazy about that concept, and not of the term either, but there's something to it that really fits quite well to what I experience is the right kind to handle scenic understanding along Lorenzerian lines. So then I'll look, as has been standard practice today, I'll look a little bit into Lorenz's meta-theory itself. Then I look into what I see as the core of the contradiction which I see in Lorenz's writings, namely there's a kind of like, there's an interchange in between modes of reconstruction and deconstruction. And that I think is extremely productive. And then I'll turn to what I'm making of it. So hold on to something, that'll be about a 50-minute ride. A few weeks ago, I had the rare opportunity to tell an interested group of highly qualified colleagues something about my psychoanalytic leanings. What are your preferred psychoanalysts or psychoanalytic orientations, I was asked, and I wasn't even dissatisfied with my answer at the moment I gave it. Freud, of course, much more so than I might have been thinking. Ernst Kris, because my PhD is about him. And of course, yeah, he's a bit unfortunate because he's one of those ego psychologists, but there's still enough in it that I like. Donald Winnicott, bit of Melanie Klein. Hans Löwald, I like a lot. And then I came out of that meeting. And on my way cycling home, it came to me a bit like a shock. I had not mentioned Alfred. I had forgotten Alfred Lorenzer. What on earth was I thinking? Was I completely out of my mind, dropping my main influence for my work? As you might imagine, a phase of self-questioning and self-analysis kicked in. Why this omission? Is there something in my relationship to Lorenzo and his work that did not make them qualify? Or has his meta-theory become such a central part of my thinking that I do not see him as an independent object anymore? Is this repression or a successful identification? Ultimately, this lecture gives me an opportunity to reassess this relationship and think through what I also see as my ambivalences. Indeed, I need to confess that it has been necessary to hold both Lorenzo close and keep him at a certain distance, to love his works, and I love his works, and be irritated by them at the same time, to be a Lorenzerian and at the same time leave him. What concretely is this ambivalence rooted in? The short answer is that this ambivalence lies in those contradictions that Lorenzo built into his theory. And I'm still not entirely sure how to read and understand and make sense of these contradictions. Did he let these contradictions seep into his writings on purpose? Did he control them? Did he realize they were there? Whatever the answer to those questions, and perhaps also what Professor Busch called, like, you know, perhaps there's also an element of playing to the audience in the early 70s. That's like some things seem to be less integrated in the writings than others, but would be interesting to discuss that further. So whatever the answer to these questions, over the past 10 or so years, reading Lorenzer has been revelatory, pleasurable, and at the same time something of a curse, where my reading has taken on a sometimes desperate search for solid ground and clear-cut answers, and where I've often gone into a mode that Lacan has described as the metonymic gliding of desire toward an ever-ephemeral object A. So what does this contradiction consist of? In my work on arrested hermeneutics, I have used the US-American psychoanalytic scholar Joel White book. And he'll come, I think Ben has invited him to the IPU, and there'll be a Zoom, and I'm really looking forward to it. So White book sets two important statements by Freud side by side. Where it was, I shall be. And the ego is not master in its own house. And he uses those to flesh out the two contradictory orientations, or kind of jarring orientations and directions that he sees as characteristic of Freud's works through art. I think they can also be used to understand Lorenzer. So these two statements, one can add, are also characteristic, respectively, and now I'm opening the perspective, for a modernist and a postmodernist attitude toward history, society, and truth. While the first statement, where it was, I shall be, can be seen as based on restorative belief that it is possible to repair and make whole again, to grasp and build universalities, to pick up the pieces and bring them together into coherent whole. By contrast, the second claim, the ego is not master in its own house, no longer holds that such reconstruction and reparation is at all possible or even desirable. The thesis that I seek to flesh out and build my own approach upon is that the oeuvre of Alfred Lorenzer is characterized by the same force field, by the same contradiction which can be found here in the ways in which his works negotiate between similarly differentiated conceptions of how to trace the unconscious. While particularly in his meta-theoretical works from the 1970s, Lorenzer conceives of the aim of clinical psychoanalysis to bring unconscious and repressed meanings back, and here I quote, back into agreement with common sense. This idea of reconstruction and reparation is also constantly suspended, relativized, critiqued, and countered, especially in the cultural analytical works of the 1980s. Say a little, like, you know, that is too neat of a division, but I think it's messy, and I'll say something about that later on. Hence, by granting psychoanalysis a restitutive and reconstructive function, but increasingly casting doubt upon such a possibility, Lorenzer can be seen to coordinate two traditions of thought that seem to be in opposition with each other. One tradition starts with Horkheimer, Adorno, and Marcuse. White book writes that, and I quote, that their acceptance of the premise that the ego and reason are intrinsically repressive or violent anticipates many post-structuralist and postmodern themes. The other tradition is represented by Habermas, Anthony Giddens, to a degree Jessica Benjamin, who all seek to develop, and I quote again, forms of rationality and identity not altogether violent. While the latter builds from the belief that a systematic knowledge is possible, the former builds from the claim that the only thing we can know is the impossibility of this knowledge. And of course, this has all to do with the notion of depth, which is central for this opposition between modernism and postmodernism. For modernism, it was still unproblematic to go into depth and to unearth the truth of things. Postmodernism, by contrast, has tended to see all interpretation and all construction of meaning as relative and situated at the surface. There simply is no depth to cultural phenomena anymore, holds postmodernism. And famously, Lacan once stated that what is said to be hidden in depth and needs to be unearthed always shows on the surface like freckles on a face when the sun has come out. So the position that I take in relation to the struggle between the modern and the postmodern in Lorenz's oeuvre falls in between these poles, and in this way seems very much in line with a recent shift in the cultural diagnosis of what the contemporary moment is, or what is the zeitgeist. Colleague and friend of mine at the department in Oslo, Tim Vermeulen, has called this new constellation of modernity a metamodernism. And I said, I'm not a fan of the label, but there is something to it. And I want to show, and this is a terrible slide. You might not see it. I'll read it out. I'll read out the quotes. So I'm quoting from Vermeulen and Vandenacker, who already in 2010, and they're still working on this. So they're making the following observations. And they're making them for the fields of arts, architecture, music, philosophy, academia. It's a quite impressive synthesis of different fields. So they write about artists here. They increasingly abandon the aesthetic precepts of deconstruction, parataxis, and pastiche in favor of an aesthetic, ethical notion of reconstruction, myth, and metaxis. Metaxis as a state of being in between. Another quote. Indeed, if simplistically put, the modern outlook vis-à-vis idealism and ideals could be characterized as fanatic and or naive, and the postmodern mindset as apathetic or skeptic, the current generation's attitude, for it is, and very much so, an attitude tied to a generation, can be conceived of as a kind of informed naivety, a pragmatic idealism. I find this quite interesting, pragmatic idealism, informed naivety. And the last quote, inspired by a modern naivety, yet informed by postmodern skepticism, the metamodern discourse consciously commits itself to an impossible possibility. Consciously or not. So this oscillating between positions fits very well to my understanding of, or perhaps better, my take on Alfred Lorenzer. Along these lines, my meta-methodology must be seen as an attempt at holding both these contradictory positions together in a primary processual logic of an either-and. It is both necessary to take on a reparative attitude in cultural analytic work, and it is impossible to pull through with it successfully or without causing harm to others. And now I come to a standard feature in Lorenzerian presentation. So I also now want to give you a brief introduction to Lorenzer, but I'll try and keep it short. It is like I want to show you more precisely where I have run into problems in my readings. Such brief introductions to the theory and method have almost become a literary genre in and of itself. Hans-Dieter König, perhaps, is the most prolific proponent, and I have read many of König's introductions to hermeneutics, in-depth hermeneutics, and I enjoyed them. Only also today we have had almost one in every major lecture, but here I go now too. So Lorenzer re-envisions Freudian psychoanalytic theory along the lines of a materialist thinking that zooms in on people's concrete interactions. It is from repeated routine and ritualized interactions that more stable forms of interaction crystallize. From the very beginning of a person's life, and we've discussed this today, is it already in the womb, as Lorenzer writes, such forms and patterns of interaction are negotiated between infant, in this case even the fetus, the mother or the primary caretaker, and then also other significant others. Initially, the infant experienced these rituals as unfolding in scenes, and yeah, we know all that. So experiences are made as embodied, affective, sensual wholes, as whole relational scenic units. And it's from these scenes that the form, it is these scenes that form the experiential foundation for each human being and their anchoring and place in the world. In Lorenz's theory, perhaps, and I'm, like I put this here together because I find it interesting. I mean, this is something that Lorenz comes back to again and again. It's like how these forms of interactions are being kind of like are being shaped and negotiated. That has something to do with the outside, and I think Lorenz is still very much had kind of a kind of Fordist conveyor belt labor there in mind. But then it's also like the ultra intimate, which I try to capture in those memes, right? But there's something that comes back now in the way that the digital tries to capture like sequences of action. For example, like the whole literature, like the whole engineering literature for the YouTube algorithm is filled with trying, like, you know, a historical approach to user interactional sequences. And that comes quite interestingly back to what Lorenz quite often evoked, those images of the industrial worker, which then somehow also is the mother. But we also have the drive in the title for this, for the conference. And in Lorenz's theory, the drives arise from the concrete forms of interaction that gain shape in the continuous interplays between the infant and the immediate surrounding. Bernhard Görlich wrote in 1988, "The intrinsic content of the discoveries marked by the term drive are scenes, corporal scenes, unconsciously installed figures of interpersonal interplay. And the social world enters a child's socialization through the social significance that seeps into the forms of interaction." If one can call it thus, the interactional turn was very much in the air around the time that Lorenz published his major works. Hans Löwald, for example, who Stephen Mitchell and Margaret Black call a radical interactionalist, he had a similar conception of the drives and their origins. He writes, "Drives understood as psychic motivational forces become organized as such through interactions within a psychic field consisting originally of the mother-child psychic unit. Daniel Stern, in turn, captured similar developmental dynamics in what he described an attunement between mother and child. Forerunners and contemporaries of his were Spitz and Mahler, and then also John Pine, and like they were also opponents in many ways. But also Sigmund Fuchs, for example, in a late paper from 1972, stated that thinking in terms of interacting processes is the best way that I have found so far to get away from the spurious dichotomy between individual and group. What I like so well about Löwald's take on the drives as organized interaction is that he puts them front and center. He puts them front and center not only for his conception of psychopathology, but also in his conception of a healthy and rich mental life. As Mitchell and Black put it about Löwald, reclaimed, unrepressed, infantile experience enriches rather than detracts from adult experience. The sea is always there, powering, enhancing, resonating through more complex, higher-level experience in which it finds new life. And hence you have my title page with the sea, like, you know, it's pushing and pushing and always there. It is sublated somewhere. So such a notion of reclaimed infantile experience is also inherent in Lorenz's theory, and it is language and symbol formation that, in the case of relatively healthy mental development, is seen to store, sublate, and contain such experience. Words or signifiers do not simply become attached to signifieds. They are not merely associated with concepts and objects out there in the world. Rather, as symbols in the full Lorenzerian sense, they also store within themselves the scenic aura of experience, right? This richness. However, and then we come to the field, like the theme of repression. Let me check whether I have something here. Yeah, something like that. Okay. There are also regular cases in which the process of symbolization and rendering conscious fails. Hence, problems arise when, during the introduction of language, this language forces a strict logical order onto the forms of interaction. Lorenzo holds that there are those forms that are so incoherent and at odds. We have heard about that today. And I think what Elfriede Löchel said about desymbolization was really interesting. I'm also not so sure about, like, you know, the relation between interaction forms and language. Is it bottom up, as Lorenzo says? Is it top down? Or is it something that becomes like folded into a more societal practice? In any case, I like the word excommunication more, especially if it is read as an activity that communicates even though it banishes. For an example of this excommunication, an article from the late 1970s of Lorenzo is a good example. He outlines here the socialization process of young boys at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. Here, boys were taken out of the familial sphere dominated by the mother and then introduced quite radically to the fatherly sphere of commerce and competition. Subsequently, what had been permissible and articulable in the motherish sphere or motherly sphere became, and I quote, became now delegated to the darkness of an individual myth, Lorenzo writes. A more contemporary example can be found in the heavily mediated sexual assault trial of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. I hope you remember that from 2018. This trial might not have brought justice to Kavanaugh's female accusers, but at least it sensitized an attentive audience to the gaps between public morals and the private morality of an all-male elite school in the US, or like we have the same in the UK. And, you know, like the deliverer for most of the UK's government is also like boarding schools with pretty harsh morals. And so my take on that is that I do believe that this happened, but I do also believe that this is really firmly excommunicated. So I really quite firmly believe that he doesn't think that anymore. So this is a weird incident. It was such a fascinating trial also. And like his performance, if one can call it that, like, you know, in oh so many words. So it was really a process of excommunicating something. Which brings me to step number 3. And now we're going into text analysis mode and a close reading of Lorenzo himself. So that now, which has come before, was the psychoanalytic situation according to Lorenzo. And I think this is a very creative and still very solid theoretical depiction of mental relational processes, be they conscious or unconscious. The confusions for me start, and I know I can feel a familiarity with other presentations today. Confusions start when Lorenzo then engages with the question of how to address, analyze, interpret the repressed, excommunicated unconscious. As I argue, this engagement takes the direction of where it is, I shall be, and the ego is not the master in its own house. In this way, there seems to be two competing visions of Lorenzo. The first one is at times stunningly naive in its aim of reconstructing and re-symbolizing what has been banned and pushed out. In The Truth of Psychoanalytic Insight, Die Wahrheit psychoanalytischer Erkenntnis, 1974, illustrates this restitutive paradigm as a one-to-one relation between a linguistic routine, or a predicator, as he calls it, and a specific form of interaction. In this illustration, each linguistic routine or predicator is linked up with a form of interaction. Each sign obtains its routine interactional pattern. Repression as desymbolization is thus understood as a locally restricted disruption of this connection, as can be seen here. The circle is to mark the act of re-symbolization, then the reinstatement of the connection between the form of interaction and its speech sign. Accordingly, Lorenzer, in his meta-theoretical writings, explains the work of scenic understanding in terms of rectification and correction. The process, he writes, in Language Destruction and Reconstruction, is oriented towards identifying the analysand's curious confusion of speech and to trace the analysand's pseudo-communicative private language, with the aim to dissolve this linguistic privatization by reconnecting forms of interaction with their signifying counterparts. Now that this endeavor was still somewhat formulated under the influence of ego psychology becomes clear in another passage in which he goes as far as to state that the aim of psychoanalysis is to bring the patient's linguistic confusion back into agreement with common sense, mit den öffentlichen Bedeutungen in Übereinstimmung bringen. A statement that in its naivety risks to counter his entire critical theoretical stance. In my work on Lorenz's hermeneutics, I argue that this straightforward and somewhat naive construction proved untenable and then was gradually reformulated. However, while there might be indeed a tendency traceable in his works that would roughly corroborate such a development, I now think that the situation is messier, it's more complicated. And Lorenz's publication of Die Wahrheit psychoanalytischer Erkenntnis, the truth of psychoanalytic insight, can be used as a central example for this messiness. Namely, in the same passage in which Lorenz offers this quite reductionist illustration, one can also find several quotations that oppose this simple model. And I read them out to you. "Nowhere does truth lie out in the open. It is only ever accessible via a critique of the factual imperative," he writes. And "the access of psychoanalysis to some form of truth leads via suffering as damaged praxis." But then he also says, "also suffering as damaged praxis is not a positively discernible finding. Also here, the in-depth hermeneutic operation must show itself as critically hermeneutic and practically changing. Truth can only be grasped in practical dialectical change." And I think this is beautiful, but it's also like we had that today also when I already pushed Professor Busch to clarify a couple of things. So a third formulation: "only those symbolic forms of interaction that have been constructed or reconstructed in the psychoanalytical procedure themselves are taken as reliable indices for the blueprint to the right life," Adorno, right? And this is not meant as a positive image or as an insurance, but merely as a hint toward the slope from the de-symbolized to symbolic forms of interaction. A hint toward the slope from the de-symbolized to symbolic forms. That is very interesting, but goes completely against this other version, right? Sentences such as these practically stand side by side such other sentences, and I come back to the first version of Lorenzer. "The task of psychoanalysis is re-symbolization, the reattachment of forms of interaction to language." Bam. Therefore, when in preparation of this lecture, I stumbled upon an interview that Siegfried Zepf and Sebastian Hartmann conducted with Lorenzer in 1984, where Zepf and Hartmann display a very similar kind of confusion to my own, that came as something of a relief. Oh, thankfully, somebody struggling just like I do. And I envied Zepf and Hartmann the opportunity of having been able to address their confusion to Lorenzer directly. However, again, with no clear resolution, as you might have guessed already. So referring to the same book that I have quoted from, Zepf suggests that some parts of it, Let me see if I have. No. So he suggests, like, some parts of that book, and I quote, can raise the suspicion that you intend to subsume the concrete phenomenon under the generality of a term. But then by contrast, he continues, Zepf continues, in other passages, I quote, it is different again. There it is clear what you mean. Helmut Dahmer, another of Lorenzer's companions, wrote about Lorenzer that his theoretical works are, and I quote, often of programmatically algebraic character. And perhaps the two versions of Cynic understanding that I find in his works embodies this algebraic character. One way consisting in a mode of movement that aims to straightforwardly grasp the truth, and a second one constantly suspending this grasp, continuously doubting, rechecking, analyzing, synthesizing, screen memories all the way down. I would love to show you one passage where I think the two Lorenzers come impressively to the fore side by side. In his later lectures, and they were published in 2002, I find this here. And he quotes Max Horkheimer and then offers a comment on this quote. Are there not historical periods, asked Horkheimer in a passage quoted by Lorenzer, in which frictionless adaption, a life filled with productivity and excitement, go against the notion of the sane and the healthy? Is it not thinkable that there are societal constellations in which a normal life, free of psychic symptoms, would itself be delusional? And that is a beautiful quote, and I was really thankful for Lorenzer to point me to it. However, while Horkheimer asks these questions so as to bring to the fore the dialectics of the psychic and the social, Lorenzer then in his comments risks to close down this dialectic again. So he writes, the examples that Horkheimer invokes indeed point towards a false ego. And in its most poignant form, not only have substitutive gratification and false consciousness merged into a symptom, but both parts, the deformed satisfaction of desire and language, now stand in the service of an ideology in which societal falsehood and individual falsehood have become unity. And I think it is exactly that notion of a unity that Horkheimer doesn't suggest here as easily as Lorenzer does it. So as happens here, and so many other times in his works, Lorenzer's works, rigid assessments of right and wrong, true and false, of ideological and non-ideological, break into a cautious and careful reading practice. As the Lacanian Lorenzerian Robert Heim suggests, such short circuits seem to derive from Lorenzer's belief in, and I quote Heim here, in a complementarity of Freud and Marx, a dialectic unity of psychoanalytic theory of the subject and Marxian theory of societal objectivity. However, in such passages, I think Lorenzer does not so much fall back onto a kind of neo-Marxism and also not fall back on Horkheimer, whose position he hinges on the caution of the question mark. He falls even behind many of his own positions as well. Productively so, but he does that. Hence, with respect to this situation, and in the final part of this lecture, and in a spirit of appreciation of Lorenzer, I now want to develop a version of Cynic understanding that holds on to both sides of this central contradiction. Restitutive orientation that seeks to reinstate the excommunicated meanings, and on the other hand, the kind of post-structuralist orientation that has moved away from this idea of restitution. And I want to do so in a comic paradigm. So while Lorenzo saw new cultural formations gaining foothold in consciousness in the form of myths and rituals, the unconscious or not yet conscious formations, in reference to Bloch, I argue might best be brought into view not only by picking up on what Lorenzo himself called the twisted and absurd ways in which symptoms, the return of the repressed, reveals itself, but also by evoking and especially by emulating and also by imitating these comic ways to a degree in analysis and interpretation. So the aesthetic of the comic, I argue, is particularly suitable for scenic understanding in that it offers a mode of thinking and experiencing that not only acknowledges paradox, parapraxis, and the non-rational as central to the human condition, but it also enlists these modes of relating in interpretive acts of sociocultural analysis. And I'll take you through those three steps, through this final here, in three short steps. The hermeneutics of the comic and the protestations of its limits is the first. Then I come to the urge to repeat, and then I end with reaching dissensus. And I'll have to introduce one more thinker to you, and that is Simon Critchley, whose works, quite psychoanalytically inflected works on the comic, I very much appreciate, and I can highly recommend them. So Simon Critchley, in an essay called Comedy and Finitude, outlines an ethics that, in contrast to much or most of the post-Kantian continental philosophical tradition, is based on a paradigm derived from an aesthetic not of the tragic, but of the comic form. And the tragic form that you'll find everywhere in continental philosophy. Hegel's vision of the tragic condition of modern ethical life, Schopenhauer's conception of force, Wucht, Heidegger's being free for death. They all show a preference for the tragic and heroic in suffering and sacrifice. Indeed, this preference Critchley also finds in Lacan's theorizing, where Heidegger's heroic purism resurfaces in the concept of being towards death. By contrast, the comic alternative that Critchley suggests is more cautious and pragmatic and oriented towards livable solutions rather than heroic and life-defying ideals. And in order to approximate these foundations, Critchley writes, here we have it, comedy is a paradoxical form of speech and action that defeats our expectations, producing laughter with its unexpected verbal inversions, contortions, and explosions, a refusal of everyday speech that lights up the everyday. Estranged, indigent, and distorted, and here he quotes Adorno, as it will appear one day in the messianic light. And it's so nice how he takes something that is so tragic into the comic. The contortions and explosions that Critchley attributes to the sphere of the comic build a parallel to those qualities in our research materials that scenic understanding is particularly drawn to, the irritating, the jarring, the bizarre, the absurd, vice versa. The scenes in a research material also frequently bear strong similarities to the estranging effects of the comic. And Elfriede Löchel mentioned that today too. When Freud writes about the workings of the primary process, that all these methods of displacement appear too as techniques of joking, this proximity of the comic to the unconscious can thus be turned productive. Walter Benjamin writes, there is no better starting point for thought than laughter. But my use of the comic is not always bound to laughter, but also to the failure of laughter sometimes. And programmatically, when Critchley in the quotation gestures towards Adorno, then he integrates the tragic telos into a practice oriented towards the comic. We can only behold of the unconscious in estranged form, and all attempts at articulating its vision inescapably All attempts at articulating its vision inescapably revert to such estrangement, stammer, parapraxis, nonsense, as the comical equivalents of what Adorno describes as the redeeming qualities of critique. I argue that the comic offers exactly this Adornian standpoint. Despite the unease that it can cause, allowing its experience to enter our practice of cultural analysis seems to me to delineate the adequate relation between researcher and research object, research material, as well as the adequate distance, perhaps also between different participants in an interpretation group. Allowing for a comic dimension in interpretation and analysis, we simultaneously go too far and acknowledge our limits. Not only is it impossible for us to assimilate the alterity of somebody else's unconscious, but in a comical turn, it is likewise impossible for us to stop trying. We are unable to grasp that which is radically different, ungraspable, but also unable to stop to attempt to do so. When Critchley describes the ethics of the comic as consisting of both the ways in which we identify with that which refuses identification, was a quote, and at the same time in experiencing ourselves as inadequate to the thing that comedy presents, this double movement defines the mode that I want to suggest for the practice of scenic understanding. Even as we laugh at and with the comic thing, Critchley writes, it laughs at us, making us look ridiculous. Yeah, here it was. And now, the urge to repeat and the enabling of impossibility. The comic form that I want to harness for scenic understanding does not only entail that we interpret in the face of imminent failure, it must also compel us to do so again and again, 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 and again. Lorenzer writes that the materials of cultural analysis, and I quote, can be read an unlimited number of times. In fact, he says, they must be read many times. In a parallel to this, the history of the comic finds a vital drive in the urge to repeatedly attempt the impossible and its exhilarating effects. Tom trying to catch Jerry, Coyote and his overblown schemes to kill Roadrunner, Stan and Ollie's absurdist creative attempts to, for example, climb a too short ladder. Those dumbfoundingly repetitive forms of interaction give us an idea of the rich reservoir of cultural techniques at our disposal to not achieve our goals. By evoking and imitating them in our interpretations, they allow us to repeatedly gesture towards the outlines of that which remains out of sight and from various angles. So again and again and again. So we are building a chimera by not catching it. Hence, by repeating a futile interaction, we unfold and constantly add to a reservoir of cultural knowledge in which each item is nonsensical but turns meaningful in aggregation. And whereas variations of failing interpretations will definitely not take us all the way to the very thing that is driving our urge to interpret, all these attempts have the potential to demarcate a field in which we can look further. Okay. Last point. Reaching the senses. What we gain when jokes turn painful. One last aspect I would like to touch here. Specifically, that the comic is not a solitary effort. It's quite seldom that we can laugh alone. Freud did that with his late work on humor. That is like a mature kind of work. But in his early works on the joke, Freud explains that in the case of tendentious jokes, we need three parties. The teller of the joke, the addressee, and the victim of the joke, the butt of the joke, right? Like, so teller, audience, and the butt of the joke. When Lorenzer writes about the work of interpretation groups that, and I quote, Everybody becomes a witness to the interpretation of the others. Everybody can examine the validity of the interpretation and must submit to such re-examination him or herself. The setting that he conjures up shows strong similarities to Freud's description of the tendentious joke. In the interpretation group, we also encounter three parties. Now it becomes really dubious. The interpreter taking on the role of the teller. The other researchers becoming the hopefully laughing thirds, the audience. Now, critically, this then refers the research object, the research material, to the position of the victim of the joke. Needless to say, equating a research material, quite often also single case study, to the butt of a tendentious joke amounts to an act of terrible aggression, bluntly introducing an aggressive charge into the act of interpretation. However, in the context of inquiries into the unconscious, such a charge necessarily accompanies potentially every interpretation. Adherents to post-structuralist theory have responded to this inevitability by disengaging with hermeneutic approaches, and we talked about anti-hermeneutics today. I argue, however, that the comic paradigm offers a way, albeit not without risks, to hold on to hermeneutics specifically by bringing the aggressive charge to the fore and by making it possible to acknowledge it. How this works becomes only too clear in the cases in which an interpreter fails to bring the other group members behind an interpretation. And that can just be a free association. All of a sudden, there's something where you feel very alone. In this situation, the aggressive charge falls back onto the researcher by way of the others rejecting it, rejecting an association, for example. In this way, a rejection has the power to lay bare the lines of conflict that run through our intra- and intersubjective relationships in particular and through culture more generally. This makes us painfully aware that the very banana peel we had been throwing in somebody else's path was what landed us on our own butts. Thank you very much.